Chapter 10, Punishment, by Brian Stevenson. A decade ago, I was in court fighting for the release of a black man named Matthew, who had been condemned to die in prison because of a crime that occurred when he was 16. A legal aid organization I'd founded, the Equal Justice Initiative, EJI, was representing Matthew, as well as many others who had been sentenced to life imprisonment without parole when they were children. When EJI was started in 1989, its purpose was to provide legal representation to people on death row. Over the years, our mission expanded to include providing legal aid to people wrongly convicted or unfairly sentenced. We also began representing condemned children, some as young as 13, serving sentences of life without parole. Today, we seek an end to mass incarceration and to the abusive and punitive way our legal system responds to trauma, addiction, and mental illness. The focus of our work, like the work of so many other individuals and organizations that have arisen throughout the nation's history to fight for and deepen our founding principles of justice and equality before the law, is the particularly punitive nature of the American legal system. The United States has the highest rate of incarceration of any nation on earth. This country contains 4% of the planet's population, but 20% of its prisoners. This is a relatively recent development. In the early 1970s, our prisons and jails held fewer than 350,000 people. Since then, that number has increased to about 2.3 million, with 4.5 million more on probation or parole. In 1980, there were roughly 40,000 people incarcerated for drug offenses. Today, that number is about 450,000. For more than three decades, our country has spent billions of dollars every year, not only on constructing prisons and jails, but also on policing and funding a carceral system that has ensnared millions. More than 200,000 Americans are currently condemned to life sentences or virtual life sentences, 50 years or longer. Disproportionately, those affected by the system are black. Racial disparities in sentencing are found in almost every crime category. For instance, researchers have repeatedly established that the race of the victim is the greatest predictor of who gets the death penalty in the United States. A study from the 1980s found that in Georgia, black defendants convicted of killing white people were almost 22 times more likely to be sentenced to death than people convicted of crimes against black victims, a racial disparity that the United States Supreme Court accepted as, quote, inevitable in a controversial 1987 case, McCleskey versus Kemp. And determinations about whether children are prosecuted as juveniles or adults and what kind of punishments are imposed reveal some of the most dramatic racial disparities. In 2008, EJI established that all of the 13 and 14-year-old children in this country sentenced to life in prison without parole for non-homicide offenses were black, Latino, or Native. We began representing these children and challenging what we call death in prison sentences across the country. Eventually, two of the cases, Sullivan versus Florida and Graham versus Florida, ended up in the United States Supreme Court. In 2009, I argued to the justices that telling any 13-year-old child you are fit only to die in prison is cruel, and that these sentences cannot be reconciled with what we know about child development or basic human rights. The court agreed and declared that life without parole sentences imposed on children convicted of non-homicide offenses are unconstitutional. The Graham decision and a 2012 case we took to the Supreme Court, Miller versus Alabama, which banned imposing mandatory sentences of life without parole on children, created the possibility of release for thousands of imprisoned people who had been condemned as minors. However, obtaining parole or release was not guaranteed. Legal appeals would have to be filed, and judges and parole boards would have to be persuaded to grant relief, That's how I met Matthew. At the time that we represented him, Matthew had been in prison for more than 40 years. He was one of 62 Louisiana prisoners serving life in prison for non-homicide offenses committed when they were children. 89% of the condemned were black. Some had been in prison for nearly 50 years. Almost all had been sent to Angola, a penitentiary that at the time was considered one of America's most violent and abusive. Angola is immense, larger than the island of Manhattan, covering land once occupied by plantations where enslaved black people were forced to labor. Some of our clients had worked in the fields for years while imprisoned under the supervision of horse-riding, shotgun-toting guards who forced them to pick crops, including cotton. Even after Supreme Court rulings, securing the release of these men usually required navigating parole review boards, which are highly discretionary. A prisoner's disciplinary record is often one of the most significant factors in parole decisions, and I was worried that some of our clients would be denied release. Some had records documenting that when they had refused to pick cotton or had failed to pick it fast enough, they had been punished with time in the hole, where food was restricted and inmates were sometimes tear-gassed. Still, some black prisoners, including Matthew, considered the despair of the hole preferable to the unbearable degradation of being forced to pick cotton at the end of the 20th century on the site of a former plantation for enslaved people. Because of disciplinary infractions like this, some of our clients were denied parole. Incarcerated people in most states have no right to counsel for post-conviction appeals, so EJI ended up taking on close to 60 cases in Louisiana. In other states, because of mandatory sentencing and three strikes laws, I have found myself representing people sentenced to life without parole for stealing a bicycle or for simple possession of marijuana. For a nation that prides itself on being exceptionally committed to freedom, America has produced an endless list of harsh, extreme, and cruel sentences across the 50 states for minor and major crimes. How did it come to this? How did we arrive at a point of so much over-incarceration, abusive policing, and excessive punishment? Why are racial disparities so pronounced throughout this system? We cannot answer these questions without understanding the legacy of slavery and the harsh, racialized instinct for punishment our history has created. It took only a few decades after the arrival of enslaved Africans in Virginia before white settlers demanded a new world defined by racial caste. The 1664 General Assembly of Maryland decreed that all Negroes shall serve durante vita, hard labor for life. This enslavement would be sustained by the threat of brutal punishment. By 1729, Maryland law had authorized punishments of enslaved people, including to have the right hand cut off, the head severed from the body divided into four quarters, and head and quarter set up in the most public places of the county. Enslaved people were punished for learning to read, for questioning their enslavement, or when rumors of escape or rebellion surfaced. In 1740, South Carolina lawmakers restricted some of the most barbaric punishments that had emerged and imposed civil fines on enslavers who, quote, cut out the tongue, put out the eye, castrate, or cruelly scald, burn, or deprive any slave of any limb or member. But it still authorized whipping or beating with horsewhip, cowskin, switch, or small stick, or putting irons on, or confining or imprisoning. Even emancipated and freeborn black people were often considered to be presumptive fugitives, to be hunted, captured, and sold into slavery. As one 19th century court ruled, the presumption arising from the color of a person indicating African descent is that he is a slave. Some northern states and territories, including Illinois, Indiana, and Oregon banned the immigration of free black people. Some southern states required that enslaved people who obtained freedom from their enslavers leave the state to avoid any confusion about what black people represented in American society. American slavery evolved into a perverse regime that denied the humanity of black people while criminalizing their actions. Bondage itself was only one part of the system. The myth of racial difference and a belief in white supremacy were another. As the Supreme Court of Alabama explained in an 1861 ruling, enslaved black people were, quote, capable of committing crimes, and in that capacity were regarded as persons, but in most every other sense they were, quote, incapable of performing civil acts, and considered things, not persons. The 13th Amendment is credited with ending slavery, but it stopped short of that. It made an exception for those convicted of crimes. Quote, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. End quote. And it could not abolish the true evil of American slavery, which was the belief that black people are less evolved, less human, less capable, less deserving, less trustworthy than white people. Reconstruction may have challenged the existing paradigm, with changes to the Constitution aimed at enforcing equality before the law, but it was short-lived and could not overcome the commitment to white supremacy evident in so many jurisdictions. The existing racial hierarchy was sustained by myths about black criminality, which led many white people to insist that only the threat of extreme and brutal punishment could preserve order where black people were concerned. After emancipation, black people, once seen as less than fully human slaves, were now seen as less than fully human criminals. Formal slavery may have ended in 1865, but the social, legal, economic, and political system built in the South to sustain slavery survived by evolving into new forms. Laws governing slavery were replaced with laws governing free black people, making the criminal legal system central to new strategies of racial control. As the provisional governor of South Carolina declared in 1865, emancipated black people had to be, quote, restrained from theft, idleness, vagrancy, and crime, and taught the absolute necessity of strictly complying with their contracts for labor. An 1866 editorial in the Macon Daily Telegraph said, quote, there is such a radical difference in the mental and moral constitution of the white and black race that it would be impossible to secure order in a mixed community by the same legal sanction, end quote. And these beliefs were not limited to the South. The slogan of the 1868 Democratic National Convention, which nominated former New York Governor Horatio Seymour as its candidate for president, was, "This is a white man's country. Let white men rule." These strategies intensified whenever black people asserted their independence or achieved any measure of success. Even before Reconstruction ended, white Americans countered the emergence of black elected officials and entrepreneurs with mob violence. After Reconstruction, rejection of racial equality intensified with convict leasing, a scheme in which white policymakers invented offenses, congregating after dark, vagrancy, loitering, that could be used to arrest black people who were then jailed and leased to businesses and farms where they labored under brutal conditions. An 1887 report in Mississippi found that 6 months after 204 prisoners were leased to a white man named McDonald, dozens of them were dead or dying. The prison hospital filled with men whose bodies bore, quote, marks of the most inhuman and brutal treatment, so poor and emaciated that their bones almost come through the skin. The death rate in some of these prison camps was close to 45%. As historian Douglas A. Blackman's Pulitzer Prize-winning book documents, it was slavery by another name. But unlike slavery, in which enslavers at least had a financial interest in keeping enslaved people alive and functional, convict leasing stripped imprisoned people of any protection and made them completely replaceable and easily discarded. In that sense, convict leasing was, as the sociologist David Oshinsky titled his book, worse than slavery. It is not just that this history fostered a view of black people as presumptively criminal. It also cultivated a tolerance for employing any level of brutality to maintain the racial hierarchy. In 1904, in Mississippi, a black man was accused of shooting a white landowner who had attacked him. A white mob captured him and the woman with him, cut off their ears and fingers, drilled corkscrews into their flesh, and then burned them alive, while hundreds of white spectators enjoyed deviled eggs and lemonade. The landowner's brother, Woods Eastland, presided over the violence. He was later elected district attorney of Scott County, Mississippi, a position that launched his son, James Eastland, an avowed white supremacist, to the United States Senate. He served 6 terms and was president pro tempore from 1972 to 1978. In the eyes of white people, black criminality was broadly defined. Anything black people did to challenge the racial hierarchy could be seen as a crime, punished either by the law or by lawless lynchings, which were an epidemic in the South, but also took place in the West and the North. In 1916, a white mob lynched Anthony Crawford in South Carolina for being successful enough to refuse a low price for his cotton. In 1918, Mary Turner complained about her husband's murder and the mistreatment of sharecroppers in Georgia, and a white mob lynched her too. In 1920, a white mob of up to 10,000 people gathered in Duluth, Minnesota, and lynched 3 black men. In 1933, a white mob lynched Elizabeth Lawrence near Birmingham for daring to chastise white children who were throwing rocks at her. This appetite for harsh punishment has echoed across the decades. Many of the well-dressed Christians and clergy members who took part in the 1955 Montgomery bus boycott were beaten, battered, and bloodied in nonviolent civil rights protests. By the 1960s, it was less acceptable to employ the same forms of extra-legal racial terrorism that had been used to constrain previous forms of black protest, but white resistance to racial equality remained strong. A new politics of fear and anger emerged and gave rise to the era of mass incarceration. Richard Nixon's war on drugs, mandatory minimum sentences, 3 strikes laws, children tried as adults, broken windows policing, these policies were not as expressly racialized as the black codes, but their implementation involved many of the same features. Today, it is black and other non-white people who are disproportionately targeted, stopped, suspected, arrested, incarcerated, and shot by the police or prosecuted in courts. Hundreds of years after the arrival of the first enslaved Africans, a presumption of danger and criminality still follows black people everywhere. New language has emerged for the non-crimes that have replaced the black codes. Driving while black, sleeping while black, sitting in a coffee shop while black, all reflect incidents in which African Americans have been mistreated, assaulted, or arrested for conduct that would be ignored if they were white. In schools, black children are suspended and expelled at rates that vastly exceed the punishment of white children for the same behavior. The smog created by our history of racial injustice is suffocating and toxic. We are too practiced in ignoring the victimization of any black person tagged as criminal. Like Woods Eastland's crowd, too many Americans remain willing spectators to horrifying acts of extreme punishment as long as they are assured that it is in the interest of maintaining order. Today, In courtrooms across America, advocates and lawyers representing Black people cannot effectively assist many of their clients without recognizing that, contrary to the legal doctrine, those clients are presumed guilty and burdened by assumptions of criminality that have been shaped over centuries. The job of the advocate then becomes convincing the court and the jurors of a client's innocence, rather than just defending the client against accusations of guilt, an inversion of the presumption of innocence written into American law. The advocate who fails to understand this reality can actually imperil the life of his or her client. Recognizing the unbroken links between slavery, Black codes, lynching, and our current era of mass incarceration is essential. Like generations before, we must struggle for an end to bigotry. We must fight to repair the damage created by centuries of racial injustice. We must commit to a new era of truth and justice, one in which we honestly confront our past so that we can understand what remedies are needed to achieve healthy communities and justice for people who have been unfairly excluded and targeted. Our nation must acknowledge the 400 years of injustice that haunt us. Truth-telling can be powerful. In many faith traditions, salvation and redemption can come only after confession and repentance. In Germany, there has been a meaningful reckoning with the history of the Holocaust. This sort of reflection and remembrance has been largely absent in America, where many people resist confronting the most disturbing and difficult parts of our past. With this in mind, in 2018, EJI founded a museum in Montgomery, Alabama, dedicated to the legacy of slavery. The grounds also feature a memorial honoring thousands of Black victims of lynching. Since we've opened, hundreds of thousands of people have visited. I've seen many of them reduced to tears after bearing witness to the traumas of our past, but I've also seen them, before they leave, resolve to make a difference. They understand, perhaps, that we are at one of those critical moments in American history when we will either double down on romanticizing a false narrative about our violent past, or accept that there is something better waiting for us if we can learn to deal honestly with our history. I sometimes speak with our Angola clients who have now been released, including Matthew. They are grateful to have survived the fields and the hole, to have endured harsh punishment amid an uncertain future. They sometimes talk about what it was like to be told, "You are beyond hope, beyond redemption, and you must stay in prison until you die." We share our convictions that people are wrong when they reduce other human beings to nothing more than their worst act. It is powerful to see individuals I met when they were condemned behind bars, living unchained lives that carry the hope and possibility of restoration. But it is also clear to me that for Matthew and others, being outside Angola's haunted plantation gates doesn't mean total freedom. Condemnation frequently leaves a mark, an injury, a trauma that weighs on you, and the conditions that gave rise to unjust condemnation for the people I represent still exist. Black people still bear the burden of presumptive guilt. A society recovering from a history of horrific human rights violations must make a commitment to truth and justice. As long as we deny the legacy of slavery and avoid this commitment, we will fail to overcome the racially biased, punitive systems of control that have become serious barriers to freedom in this country. It's tempting for some to believe otherwise, but much work remains.